accession number 20457, reel 5.
Brigadier Randall, reel 5.
What happened after you'd withdrawn over the bridge at
Well, I took my cup. We were in some sort of bamboo thickets out on the middle of the plain, and then in the middle of the night, there was this colossal bang, which woke us all up, and we realised that the bridge had been blown. So at dawn, I think CO said, we'll go down. So we went down to the west bank and did what we could to help people who were coming across the river. There was a fleet of fair cows that were Gurkhas and British soldiers and all swimming across, some wounded, and we just did our best to...
What could you actually do to help them?
Well, nothing except just go into the water, and I could quite pass and sort of drag it, help a chap up, really, and I think we sort of brewed them up some tea or something, but we hadn't got very much ourselves, really.
Were the Japanese actually on the other bank?
Yeah, there was a certain amount of mortar fire, desultory sort of mortar fire, and a bit of a long-distance machine gun fire. It was just a sort of scene of utter chaos, really. While I was with Sam Manickshaw, I'd seen the Dukes coming over the bridge. It's always an evocative sight, seeing troops moving up the line. There they were coming over the bridge, going into battle, whistling and usual sort of Tommy stuff. And then, of course, there less than 24 hours later, they were coming back, chaps mostly with swimming across, most of them without weapons, because it's not very easy to swim a river like that with a rifle. So it was a fair scene of chaos, really.
Did you put any fire across the river to keep the... No.
Well, it was quite broad there, and I think fire would have not been very effective. But the situation on the other side was so confused. I mean, we could see lots of Gurkhas and British soldiers there, and then you could see clearly where fire was coming from, the Japanese, and therefore... To have fired off the Japanese certainly were out of range of our weapons, and it would have been it really wouldn't have helped, I don't think, to have. So certainly we weren't ordered to, and it's in common sense that probably would do more harm than good if clearly identified.
Were they intermingled then on the
bank? Well. Just at the far end of the destroyed bridge, it was British. It was a bit north that the Japanese were. But then most of the Japanese who were pressing them weren't all coming from the river. They were coming from the east, really. But there was a lot of smoke and the sort of fog of war, really. So it really wasn't practical to do anything in the way of firing the Japanese, but all we could really do was just to help chaps out of the water and give them a fag and a cup of tea, which was probably the best thing we could do for them.
What was the most important thing, the fag or the cup of tea?
It's a good question, actually. I don't know. I think probably a cup of tea did them more good, but a fag probably did more for them raw.
You haven't said anything about the Burmese. Population
of Burma since you arrived in Rangoon? Yes. Maybe we won't have much with them. Certainly at the Battle of Pan, or Kuzhou, we're talking about, as I went down that night, down with my company to relieve them, and before we ran into Japanese, there was, all the way along, there was tap, tap, tapping, and this sounded a bit suspicious. So I remember halting and sending a little side patrol out to try and find what happened, but there weren't any Burmese about. There was no doubt about it, and reading Lyle Grant's book, the Japanese had sent informers and people in, and the Burmese in that area were certainly cooperating with the Japanese. On my way back, and just before I hit the Don Tama River and the first 7th Gurkhas, I went into a village. Well, first of all, I met a single Burmese cultivator, and we had no water. So he gave us water, and he gave us some of this rough sugar, and that did an enormous amount of good for us. In fact, after the war, I went back to try and give him a reward, but I never found it. Then we got into this village, and there was a very hostile feeling there, and my two soldiers I had with me had thrown their rifles away, I'm ashamed to say. I had my revolver, and I could see them eyeing this, and I think if I hadn't been armed myself, they would have probably attacked me. So by that time, and then, of course, at the Sitang River battle, I mean, the CO of the Dukes was actually, having managed upstream somewhere to get across the river, was actually attacked and killed by Burmese dacoits with a dar. So, but certainly by the time of the Sitang River battle, we had came to the conclusion that the Burmese were not very pleasant sort of people. And that they were definitely pro-Jap.
Had you had any previous warning that this might be the case?
No, we hadn't. There was any political input at all, really. We'd had really no briefing. I mean, we didn't really know the difference between a Burman on the one hand and the Karens, who were pro-British further east, and then the ring of hillmen, the Shans, the Kachins, the Chins, and the Nagas. We knew nothing about any of these people. We'd had no sort of briefings at all, really. Whether it made any difference, I don't know. We acquired this information from practical experience or later on by briefings, but the answer to your question really is no. I mean, we knew nothing about Buddhism. We had no briefings about how to avoid offending them in their temples, their Pungichongs. No, there was, looking back at it, I mean, it was bloody shambles, really. It's not the way to go to war.
But you were improvising, weren't you, as you were going along?
Well, you were learning, you were improvising, and there's nothing like practical experience.
If you survive it.
If you survive it, and you learn fast, of course.
So the Sitang Bridge was demolished, you helped the troops coming across the river.
Yes. And then we were ordered to march to a place called War, and then we reformed there and went and dug in round Pegu. Really, the battalion, you see, we lost another 100 men at the Sitang because all our transport, considerable transport, and our B echelon was all on the wrong side of the river. And so we were down to about 200 men. Well, I think we'd been about 700 or 800 strong, so we'd lost about 800, I think.
You'd lost about 75% of your
strength. That's right, and we'd lost a lot of officers too. We're only down to 5 officers.
What sort of state were the soldiers in at this stage? Were they looking demoralised, or were they bearing up well?
Well, to be honest, they weren't in very good fettle. But we were still a disciplined, cohesive force. The Pathans went to pieces. I don't know them. I mean, I could talk for hours about Pathans. They're a very mercurial race. As you know, they're probably the toughest fighters in the world. They're the chaps who saw the Russians off. They don't come any tougher, but they're mercurial, and they're very susceptible to leadership. The A Company commander had been taken prisoner. The super subadar they had, Zareen Khan, had been killed. And they went to pieces. So much so that we actually had to disarm them. I still command the PM lot. They weren't in high morale, but they weren't all that bad. They were sort of fatalism, sort of settled in, really.
It's often said that Muslims are more fatalistic, that they believe that...
In Sharjah and all that, yes.
Yes. And yet both Pathans and Punjabi Muslims were both...
Pathans, yes. I mean, the Pathan is mercurial. I mean, he's not much... His sort of morale get up and down. I mean, on their day, you know, there's nothing that'll stop it now. They'll go through anything, you know. I mean, and they look, the endurance they put up fighting the Russians was simply concrete. Anyway, that particular state, I mean, I commanded the Bataan Company later on, so I know a lot about them. Oh, I think I do anyway. But that, anyway, the fact is at that stage they went to pieces. So much so that... that we disarmed them.
What effect did that have on them? Because to most soldiers to be disarmed would be great.
Well, we did have one unfortunate case of desertion. A Pathan Havildar was due to come back and rejoin. He'd been for some reinforcement, and he took about 10 young Pathans with him, for which he was court-martialed and sentenced to death. Well, we court-martialed him afterwards when we got out. But then, you see, the fact was that the country, Burma was beginning to disintegrate. There were beginnings of vast quantities of Indians who weren't going to stay behind in Burma beginning to flow out
as refugees.
And I think the Indian soldiers... I think their loyalty and their discipline, they weren't, to say that they were upbeat would be rubbish, the same as anybody at Dunkirk was upbeat. But we were still a disciplined force and prepared to fight and, as we did.
But were the Punjabis generally, constitutionally, more stolid than the Pathan?
I think so, yes. They're less mercurial. They're not such fanatical. They're not such strict Muslims. In fact, I mean they're strict, but I mean the Pathan is fanatically so. I think temperamentally they are. More placid, more stolid. I think that's true to say.
What was the position like at Pago where you took up?
Well, we were just dug in. We didn't do any. In fact, we did practically no more fighting for the rest of the campaign, to be quite honest. So we just dug in. I think the Cameronians were around there. We got a lot of bombing. There's pattern bombing, carpet bombing over there, but then we were pulled out. We got marginally involved at the Tokyan Crossroads battle, you know, when the Japanese were going into Rangoon and the British Army were trying to get out. And we met sort of halfway, and the Gloucesters did rather well in clearing the thing.
Did the pattern bombing actually have a greater impact?
No, because you. I remember the particular time you could see these sort of crumps coming towards you, and you thought, Christ, you tried to work out anyway. When it got a bit closer, you dived, and then the awful relief when you had a thing woof over it and it had gone behind you. But I mean, as a means of it's. Pointless, really. I mean, it was a waste of talent. They were bombing from, I don't know, 10,000-12,000 feet. So, I mean, it was useless because it was so haphazard. It didn't do one's morale any good, but from point of view of actually damage was negligible. If your actual slit trench wasn't hit, you were perfectly all right.
What about the town of Pago? Was there anything damage there?
I don't remember, because he didn't come back through Pego. Next time we saw Pego, I was involved in attacking the place. 4 years later. No, 3 years later. I don't think he did know Flor Domo. No, I couldn't tell you then, because when we pulled out, we didn't go through the town. We had to cross over the river somewhere. I'm really rather vague about it, but I certainly spent 4 or 5 days there in a defensive position, but we weren't attacked, and apart from this bombing, there was nothing really, no.
How were you moving on these moves to the rear? Were you going on foot, or were you moving in transport?
Well, we lost most of our transport at the Sitang, because none of our own transport got across. Nothing. So we were issued with a lot of vehicles out of a depot. Because most of our drivers had been lost on. So we didn't have. We only had about half a dozen. We had about five or six. Dirty hundredweight, 3 tons really.
Were you able to get all your troops in? Oh
no, no. When we moved, we had to have. We still moved by train somewhere after Takian. We certainly moved by train up north towards Prome. I had quite an interesting experience, because while we were holding a bridge near Pegu, the CO said to me, "Look, each battalion's been given an official looting post. And I want you to take one of these trucks and a small fatigue party, and you've got authorized, here's the pass, you can go into Rangoon and loot anything that you think is going to be of value to your soldiers, to the soldiers." It was an astonishing experience, really. Sorry, is this relevant? And so off I went, and because of all the bombing, all the locals had moved out of Rangoon. So it's quite a large city. And it was rather odd going in there in the middle of the day. There's, you know, miles and miles of civilized, sophisticated city, absolutely empty. I met some red caps who wanted to know my business. I showed them my pass. I said, "Carry on." And I went down at the docks. There was some Marines chucking whiskey, cakes of whiskey, into the Rangoon River, saying something like, "Not going to let these buggers have this good whiskey." And I managed to get truckload of fags and tins of milk for the soldiers. I got some booze for the officers. And by chance, I went to the Army Navy stores, which I thought would have either been looted or locked up, but it wasn't. And I just walked in, and I suddenly realised it's all like walking into Aladdin's cave. There was this place, and I could have any damn thing I wanted. I think all I got was extraordinary, really. I can't think why. I got a set of golf clubs, which was the most useless thing. And I got a whole lot of books, including Freud's Anatomy of Sex, which was full of case histories, which was very popular reading. It was circulated around the companies, by my fellow company commanders. But I was received back well, because, I mean, we had really vast quantities of goodies for the soldiers and booze for the officers. Anyway, it was a funny odd business, man. It was the only time I've ever been allowed to officially loot.
Did you see any other looting parties?
Yeah, I met some other chaps, some other and we were talking, you know, where's the place to go for this or that, and then, I passed them on a good tip and they passed me on, you know. Yes, it was it made sense. Funnily enough, years later, I was at a cocktail party and I met a sort of top chap in the Army and Navy stores. And I told him this story, and I thought he'd be rather amused by it. But he imagined some sort of criminal. I got the feeling he was going to write a rude letter and send me an invoice or something. He didn't think it was at all funny. Rather dreary man, I thought. I mean, what I didn't take, the Japs would have had anyway, so.
Did your logistic arrangements carry on in a satisfactory way during this retreat?
It's a great tribute to the staff work under Slim that really we didn't suffer any noticeable deprivation at all during the retreat. I can't remember the name of the chap who's his principal staff officer, but I reckon he's one of the great administrators of World War II. I could look him up, but he's in the book. But I mean, but no, we didn't. We were never short of anything. We were a bit short of water, but only in a temporary sort of sense. But I mean, there was always petrol for our few vehicles. There was never a shortage of ammunition. We weren't short of food. And there we were marching out in the heat, and there were days, you know, when water were temporarily a bit short because you'd drunk it all. But I mean, there was always, when you got into wherever you were going, there was always seemed to be a sort of a facility to fill up the chuggles and, you know, the water bags, the chuggle, and the pakols, which is the big water carrier. So, really, I have nothing but praise for the Ministry of Logistic Arrangements. They were absolutely, given the conditions, they were absolutely first class. In fact, though the retreat was a military debacle, it was thanks, I think, to Slim, who's my great hero. There was no sort of chaos. I mean, you always knew where you were going to next, what you had to do. You had the feeling all along that your commanders knew what they were up to, and that you were working to a proper sort of plan.
It was under control.
Under control.
How did you actually get your orders? What was the normal method by which?
Well, we were so weak that we and the 5th, 17th Dogras, what was left of them, and what was left of the 4th, 12th, 21st, because we all had the same, we either all had Punjabi Muslim Pathans or Dogras, we were formed into a sort of composite battalion. So for sort of tactical purposes, we were given a sort of tactical role as a battalion. But then I shot after, I my leg went very badly septic, and so the modern word is hospitalised. I went off to a field ambulance, and then I went up a paddle steamer up the Irrawaddy, up to Mandalay, and then went to a place called May Mew. And then as soon as I got in that cool climate, my leg healed up, and so I was offered to fly back. I didn't really think I felt I ought to go back to join the battalion, and there was no reason why I shouldn't. So I then rejoined the battalion at a place called Nutmark. So I wasn't with the battalion for about a fortnight or so in the middle.
When was the composite battalion formed?
It was formed really after Satang battle, really, or certainly after Tauke Yan, anyway. Colonel Donnie Edwards of the 4th, 12th Frontier Force.
And, I mean, how did he carry on orders? Did he have battalion O groups on a regular basis, or did he send written orders by runner?
No, I think he had sort of... I didn't go to one because my acting CO, this chap Pat Dunn, he went to his orders, and the acting CO of the 5th, 17th went along, I think. Anyway, I got my orders from this chap Pat Dunn.
How did he deliver them? Did he just come and deliver them face-to-face, or more formal?
No, face-to-face. We called an O group, and we just get the orders. But then he had an accident, and then he... Shortly after I got into this hospital ship, he joined me because he'd had a traffic accident or something like that. So
how was it that you got wounded and got killed?
I wasn't wounded. I wasn't wounded.
What caused the sepsis then?
Well, way back in India, one used to wear things called chaplis, and it was a sort of sandal with socks, and there was a stuff called, not prairie grass, but something like... Anyway, it had all these sort of needles and things in it. And it had got slightly septic there, and then in one or two marches and places, and it went septic.
Was this a common complaint?
There's quite a lot of I was always prone to eczema as a young man, and I think it was a combination of the two. I mean, I didn't go easily, but it got much worse, and the doctor said, or Field Ambulance chap said, it's no good you going on like this, because it'll get very... And this time it will go really septic, and you might even lose your leg, so that I was shipped off.
How did they evacuate you? Was it by motor ambulance, or by...
The Field Ambulance was in a prison. I was there, and then... They decided, I was there a couple of days, and then they decided they were going to... So we then went in the motor ambulance, and we got on this ferry, packed with wounded, and a lot of cholera casualties. It had a great Red Cross on it. Shortly after we got on, some Japanese fighters appeared and dived over it, and we thought that they were going to bomb it. But in fact, I have to say that they respected the Red Cross, but... The message was quite clear, get the hell out of here. So we cast off, and we spent about 5 or 6 days going up the Irrawaddy.
What sort of treatment did they give you?
Not much. It was a bit of a shambles, that boat. It wasn't properly organised. I mean, I wasn't too bad. I think I got the sulphur drugs I had there, and I think... But I remember... I was in a sort of cabin with this chap, Pat Dunn, who'd arrived, and I remember in the night, you know, there were a lot of wounded who were not being properly looked after. I remember getting out myself and going to give chaps water and stuff, and they're all mixed up with battle casualties and a lot of cholera casualties, and it wasn't a very... It wasn't very well run, it wasn't at all, but then they hadn't got the resources there. It wasn't the sort of starch blue, wet sort of stuff at all.
Apart from cholera, were there any other diseases that were prevalent?
Not at that time, no. There was a certain amount of ordinary enteritis. But, I wasn't. I could still walk about, limp about a bit, and help a bit. So we did the best we could for to give chaps water and that sort of thing. Actually, have a chat with people and that sort of thing. But then we got on a hospital train and then we at Mandalay. And there was a very good Anglo-Burmese nursing sister who was jolly good to me. I think my leg wasn't responding, but she started really putting these sulphur drugs on. And I think that was the turning point. And then when we got to Mae Mew and up in the cool of the hill station, it cleared up remarkably quickly. And Pat Dunn, who was the CEO, he came up to Mae Mew, but he was flown out. And
you went back.
I heard there was a party of my soldiers, of my battalion, come up to get some wheeled carriers, and there were some from the KOILI. So I was put in charge of this little gang of British soldiers and Indian soldiers, and we had half a dozen of these wheeled carriers to go back and rejoin the battalion. To be honest, I don't think anybody really knew. I think they were sitting in a depot, and somebody said, well, they are armoured against small arms, and they might be of some use to the chaps down, and they're certainly no use up in this depot. So I think it was really a question of that, really. I'm not sure that they fulfilled any useful tactical purpose.
What were they supposed to do? Were they armed with a Bren gun or something like that?
There were the track Bren gun carriers.
Yeah.
But these were wheeled ones. On my way down, I suddenly got to this crossroads, and there was a tremendous gaggle of red tar. I realised after that it was Alexander, Slim, and Bruce Scott. Anyway, Slim or somebody said, what are you doing boy, or what are you doing? And I said, sir, I'm on my way